Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top 300 trade sales for October 2016. These are what are sold from Diamond to the retailers, so it's sell-in information, not sell-through information. Obviously, with trade paperbacks, these are items that tend to sit on the store shelves for quite some time in some cases. Obviously, there are things that people are snatching up the day it comes out, but other copies of those same things may sit on the shelf for a year or more. Which I always find interesting because the trade side has such a healthy reorder activity aspect to it that the comic side just doesn't have, by and large. So it's funny because I've been having to do a lot of rethinking on the analysis on the comic book side as the marketplace has kind of changed to where a fairly significant amount of titles are shipping multiple times a month or something. And it just the shape of the periodical side has changed. Whereas on the trade side, it's always been, you know, a different thing from that. Even with the increased frequency on the periodical side, meaning an increased frequency on the trade side, it's still a little bit, you know, of it's going to be every 3 months before you get a Batman trade or new Batman trade or whatever. So I'm debating if it makes sense to be having more of a potentially a title-centric viewpoint on some of this on the trade side or not, and I'm leaning towards not, just because the nature of short-lived titles means you're going to have multiple, you know, Hawkeye Volume 1s over time or something.
Yeah.
It's just, it's interesting how similar and how radically different the two sides of the equation are here. And of course, that invisible third side of the digital sales, I think, is a major factor.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I don't know what website it was. It might have been The Beat. It might have been somewhere else, like Multiversity. But they were talking about how as solid as like the single issue sales for Ms. Marvel, all, you know, they're not like insane, but they're like a solid, consistent number. The trade sales for Ms. Marvel are outstanding. In fact, they're in the Nielsen like top 100 books, and there's just they make a huge amount more money in the book market for Ms. Marvel than they ever do on single issues. And that's completely discounting even what the digital is. And I think that book is a solid digital. At one point, there were rumors that it was selling more digital copies than print copies. So, you know, there are more and more books nowadays that are just, they're almost publishing it, you know, individually in individual issues is kind of like the market paradigm for all of comics. But the mass majority of money, more and more titles are coming out to be in collections or digital or subscription service, things like that.
Well, I think the thing to point out there is there's different audiences, obviously, for the periodical, for the trade, for the digital. They overlap, but there's a different – certain titles are going to resonate more or do better in one market versus the other potentially. But also in terms of the dollars that the material brings in, I think there are a couple of important ways to kind of partition that. The first is what money do you get kind of the soonest and is used to fund the new content creation? That's where I think solid, steady, but maybe not stellar sales on the periodical side is crucial, because that means you can keep producing more material.
No, and I completely agree with that. But there is a point at which, and you actually see this model being used by the more popular image creators, where they will actually use, if like let's take for instance the number three selling book this week, this month, East of West Volume 6. Well, Jonathan Hithman makes quite a bit of money from his license work, but he uses a bunch of his money from trades and things like that to subsidize all of his other little projects. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing to be pointing out with the trade side is in many cases, this is going to be the majority of money the material makes, because it's got a bit more of that long tail effect, and it's got an amazingly longer shelf life. I mean, that volume of East of West, volume six there, you know, I don't know how often it'll show up on the list, but it will continue selling kind of perpetually as long as that series goes on, whereas the component issues that make up that trade, sales are over and done with. That's it.
Yeah.
So there's, again, that what funds the content creation, and then what is that long-term funding of the creator and the stability of the creator that comes into play?
Yeah. And, you know, even creators like, you know, Jim Zub have talked about, you know, with the way that Image has switched to where they're now requiring you to get 3 or 4 issues in the can, it actually unbalances the way the it makes it much harder for new people to break in, because it's much harder for those people to have the capital to invest in paying an artist to work for 3 or 4 months, whereas someone like Hickman or Jason Aaron, they have money coming in from multiple streams, and they can afford to not take a paycheck on a creator-owned work for 6 months a year and make sure that the artist is getting paid, and then they just see it all on the back end. You know what I mean? It's like they're creating their own, like, publishing verticals.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's an aspect of the marketplace favoring the already successful and allowing them to continue to be successful. And again, it comes down to if you or me were to say, hey, let's go do a comic book, oh gosh, we've got to have 3 issues out or ready to go before we can solicit. That means the cost, again, of the artist, the letterer, the colorist, the inker, all that kind of stuff, the production costs for those issues, we got to eat that before that first issue gets solicited. Then it's going to be a few months before it comes out, and another few months before we start seeing money on that.
Exactly.
So you're talking about having if it's an ongoing thing, about a year's worth of money going out potentially before you start seeing it coming back.
Yeah. So that's why I think it's hard. It's you see less new creative talent at Image that hasn't had a chance to establish itself at other places. Or you see that a creator is doing 3 or 4 licensed books for Marvel, DC, or another company, and then they have their Image book that it's like a day job and a hobby. The day job is the license work. And then, you know, technically it's not a hobby because they're, you know, it's a business venture, but they're hoping to, you know, pour the resources they get from working for Marvel DC. And then once they get their name established and if they can build a successful series, you know, that's kind of like you work your way up the ladder kind of thing.
Well, there's the pay the bills work in the passion projects.
Yeah. Well, and like you were saying, if you have to put out money for a year before seeing any back, that can be one of the bills, right? The bills for my creator-owned work that I'm trying to develop.
Yeah. Imagine you're writing 3 or 4 books so you can pay for the artist on the one book you would really like to be doing.
Yeah, your own creative endeavor that, you know, is a small percentage chance but has the potential, you know, going forward to be things like The Walking Dead or Saga or something else, even smaller things, and you own it, you know what I mean? So it's kind of like you're taking money from, you know, like a 9-to-5 or job, and you're putting it, you know, potentially investing in the future. So I'm not saying it's a bad strategy, but you can just see that the creators who have had a head start, you know, that have cachet that built up, you know, like a Hickman, they have a big advantage because they can basically front that money and not have to worry about it. You know what I mean? Obviously, like if they have enough books that bomb, it is a problem, but not in general.
But there's an aspect of renting versus owning, I think, to be had here. When you're working on those company-owned projects, you're essentially in that kind of rental model.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you're getting the money, you're not paying the money out, but it's good for the month or whatever, and that's it. Whereas when you're doing your own project, you're building up equity. You've got something that you've made your investment on, you get your money out or whatever that month, or you don't, but it's something that can build up over long term and have dividends down the line. You know, the Young Avengers title that Gillen and McKelvey did over at Marvel did well for them. It certainly made them some money, got them some additional notoriety, as if they needed that. But it's one of those that once that project is done, it's done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've gotten paid for their creative stuff. Maybe they'll get some, you know, residuals as the trade sells or whatever. But the equivalent amount of time that they put in on The Wicked and the Divine, that's something that can pay off in spades for them 5-10 years down the line, depending how they manage the project and the property.
Uh-huh.
So it's not only are there different audiences, there's different aspects of the revenue stream and longevity aspects of it for these creators to be thinking about. And there are some creators that are really good at the creative side of it, but, you know, maybe not so brilliant on the business side of it. There are others that I think are brilliant on the business side of it and good enough on the creative side to really run with that. I would go with Mark Millar on that side of it. He's got a good track record as a creator. I'm not going to say he's the best guy out there. He's certainly in that upper category, no doubt. But it's his business sense and acumen in being able to turn a lot of these things into movie projects or at least options. And he's been working on building up a library of properties versus just having the one property and running it for 10 years or something.
Yeah, it's true.
It's just very different mindset. And there's nothing to say that his mindset on his stuff was the right way to go, or Kirkman's on Walking Dead focusing not exclusively but predominantly on one property was the right way to go or the wrong way in either case. You know, it comes down to, you know, how well can you take with the cards you've got and how well can you play them?
Yeah.
If we take a look at the breakdown real quick, it's 26.16% of the units went to Marvel, 23.83% went to Image, 22.66% to DC. This is kind of interesting for DC to be in third place because typically they're in first place. The spread, though, between DC and Marvel is, what, 12,000 units or something? So it's not a huge spread. But then you add up the other publishers, and they account for an additional 27.35%. So, again, it's kind of that rough four-way split between Marvel, Image, DC, and everybody else. In the everybody else category, the two that did the best were Dark Horse and IDW.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that should be too terribly surprising to anyone. If we look at it by units, of course, Marvel had the largest, or not by units, by dollars. Marvel had the largest share of the dollars with 30.75% of the dollars for the top 300 trades. Image had 18.54, DC had 25.81. Again, that's a reflection of the average cover price. And in the cases of Marvel and DC, them having some higher ticket items on the board versus actually over twice the cost of the highest ticket item over at Image. Marvel and DC had items at $125. Image's top dollar was $59.99. So that's just kind of the way it goes. In terms of the remainder of the publishers, they accounted for 24.9% of the total dollars. So again, a roughly four-way split, but favoring Marvel heavily just because they tend to have more expensive material.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've been able to do that because they've been creatively fairly strong over the past couple of years. I think right now is not one of their creative peaks. And I'm hearing a lot of kind of dissatisfaction, I guess would be the way to put it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that they, you know, every once in a while you get the cadence gets out of order in terms of some people may not agree with this, but I think that some people kind of vacillate between the two big two. So, you know, when Marvel was having his renaissance was kind of in the middle or the tail end of the DC 52. And so people would be like, oh, I'm just going to pick up more of these books, and they shun DC. And then the rebirth was actually pretty good for DC in terms of quality of stories in general. You know, you always have a few duds, but so, and at that time when there was a huge amount of interest and the non-returnability, I cannot tell you how important that is for the comic shops to really take a risk, but they went heavy on that, and it just so happened that the material was good enough, and it also happened that Marvel was kind of in a little bit of a lull, or they were transitioning, or they got caught where their, you know, event series again was supposed to be 7 issues, then it was pushed to 8 or 9, and then they were late by 4 or 5 months, you know. So, you know, some of it's shooting themselves in the foot, some of it is they got caught by their competition in the superhero domain actually doing a good product and good push at the same time. I think that's part of it.
I agree with both sides of that. I think the rebirth stuff was the creative shot in the arm DC needed, and the fact that that timed out during kind of a misstep in the cadence over at Marvel really worked to DC's advantage.
Mm-hmm. And not – so there's always – I think for the big two, obviously for other parts of the industry it's different. For the big two, there's two sides to it. I think there is an absolute core of superhero readers that will read the stuff no matter how much – how almost terrible it is. And I know you and me disagree about how good or bad superhero comics are sometimes. But I think that you can have good books, but if you don't have good advertising and good policies for the retailers like returnability, you can actually really hurt yourself in terms of not seeing sales. But if you do a two-pronged approach and you actually nail both ends of it, you can have what I think DC has had with Rebirth, a really solid improvement.
Absolutely. I think the fact that DC supported the Rebirth stuff with returnability for the first, I think, six issues, I forget exactly how long or something, was a major factor in its success. Mm-hmm. And I believe Marvel's been trying to do something similar with overshipping some of their stuff for free to retailers again, trying to hit that saturation point on some stuff.
Yeah.
But the thing that's always annoyed me with the marketplace for comics is the publishers have the most information about the quality and nature of the material. Arguably, the retailers have the most insight as to the specifics of the customer base and what they want. Granted, that's very decentralized. Mm-hmm. But the retailers are having to take on the risk of the material sight unseen in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the few pages you might get of preview material during the solicitation cycle is often not enough. The typical cover image and, you know, three sentences or something is certainly not enough to be building up interest and story momentum on for the reader side. So
yeah,
I'd
sense.
Like to see the risk equation kind of shift around a little, and the a better communication from the retailers to the publishers of what the readers really do and don't want, and better information from the publishers down to the retail level of are they providing that or not. Easy to say, hard to do, because the publishers really can't give out too much more information without it just hitting, you know, bleedingcool.com or any of the other comic book news sites and kind of almost stealing their own thunder. I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned in this day and age of social media about when and if you release certain information, particularly about stories, about creative endeavors, because it can really either amp up the excitement about the project or more likely really kind of distract people from aspects of it and detract from its overall success.
Yeah. One thing I wonder about Marvel with the last two or three events that have literally just drug out, and why don't they literally, they have the money and they have the knowledge of that. These companies are so big, they cannot not plan out stuff for like 6 months to a year at a time. Why not literally, you know, 8 months before the series is supposed to start, have the writer and the artist do it, literally pay them, because you know you're going to pay them their page rate. Do it. Don't even submit issue to previews until the entire series is done. And why do they keep having soliciting it as 7-issue series and then start tacking on 8 and 9 at the end? I just don't understand. Like,
well, if it's selling well, wouldn't you want to sell more?
Oh, God. Yeah, but if you get it out on time, like, come on.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's a matter of it selling so well is why they've extended Civil War II. They, in some cases, have done that where they've worked pretty far in advance. Mm-hmm. I don't think they've gotten the entire thing done before it goes out, but there have been a few cases where, and I think it was Age of Ultron, they actually had to redraw a couple of characters in the first issue because of what had changed between when they'd done that and when it was going to come out.
Gotcha.
And that's the problem with a shared universe and that kind of an event.
That's true. It's hard to, if you don't want it to be a side story that has no repercussions, you know, you kind of have to play into what's going on, and you can't plan 64 series a month that far ahead. I understand that. That doesn't make sense.
Even if you just want to have the crowd scene of all the heroes are there.
Yeah.
Well, it means you got to know which heroes are going to be there.
Which one? Are alive, which ones are
but
in another
one,
galaxy, yada yada.
One could argue that, say, in the 80s, you could have done that because the rosters were reasonably stable,
yeah.
Characters didn't die and come back that often, things of that nature. So I think there's an aspect, you know, it's funny to be saying that in a day and age where the average storyline takes about 6 issues to play out. So you would think if they even just work a story arc ahead of that in terms of the big picture, not even the minutia of it, they should be working about a year in advance. Whereas they were able to do this kind of coordination at Marvel and DC back in the day where over the course of a year, 7 or 8 stories would play out with some ramifications. So I think it's a matter of coordination. I think it should be doable. Apparently it's not, but it should be.
Yeah.
But I think the expansion of these events, which is commonplace over at Marvel, as are the delays, is something indicative of how they operate. Because while we sometimes get some delays over at DC on their events, I don't recall any events off the top of my head that expanded in length.
Mm-hmm.
So they at least know the story they're setting out to tell ahead of time. And I think Marvel should too.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Now, if we jump over to the top 300 trades list itself, what I found kind of interesting was the top item. It was a $7.99 item. How many pages was this? Was this something that looked like a comic or actually looked like a trade? It had five comics in it, so probably looked like a trade. It was Champions No Time for Losers number one, 7,366 units. This was reprinting stuff from the 70s.
Huh, interesting.
Well, if you think about it, they lost the trademark or whatever for Champions.
Oh, okay.
For the longest time. And they were able to successfully negotiate with the people they needed to get it back for the new series. So this allowed them, for the first time in decades, to reprint, really for the first time since the trade paperback era, I would argue, to reprint any of the Champions stuff under the name Champions.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see where this may have just been hard to get for the longest time. It's odd that it was issues 1, 2, 3, and then 14 and 15, but they may have already done a complete collection of the Champions stuff. I'd have to go over to my bookcase and see if I've got, like, maybe an essential or one of the classic ones they did at some point.
Yeah, that's definitely before my time. I'm not familiar with any of that stuff.
Well, it's a series I haven't actually read. I may have some of these issues either in trade or in the individual issues, but I haven't read them if I've got them. And I'd have to go dig around and see if I do. This was an LA-based super team that had Beast, Iceman, Black Widow, Hercules. I take it back. It had Angel, Hercules, Black Widow, Ghost Rider, and Iceman. I was mm-hmm. thinking it was Beast. It was Angel. It was, you could argue, it was the Unity Squad long before the Avengers had one, because it had both mutants and Avengers in it. But for something that's material of a couple of decades old to be topping the list, I find that very interesting. And one could argue that it's not even A-list material from the time. It's just that it hadn't been collected before.
Huh. And it is, well, the retail rank is a little low. Do you think it was discounted really well?
Well, it's also about half the price of most of the other items on the list.
$7.99. Yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
So I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the lower priced items on the list.
It's just, and that's where Diamond put it, huh? They decided not to put it on the periodical side, huh?
They at a five issue collection, I'm assuming it's 128 pages or some such. I tend to use the general rule of thumb of if it's got a square binding but is not just a 64-page or whatever prestige book, it's probably a trade.
Mm-hmm.
But that's obviously just one of many rules of thumb. This is one that easily would have been just as comfortable on the comic list as on the trade list. But they've got a couple other things on the trade list this time that I don't know that I would have put there. We've got a number of coloring books this time around. Again, not something new, but I don't think these coloring books contain the word balloons. I could be wrong on that. And I don't think they're like a sequential story. So to me, they fall into the book category, not into the trade category.
Yeah, I actually would agree with you there. I've obviously, you know, we've talked about the huge market that there appears to be for the adult coloring books, but I've yet to actually buy one because it's just not my thing, and I only have so much money, and I would not spend it on an adult coloring book ever. But I did not realize that they kept the bubbles. I thought it was literally just the plain line art, and then the people could color it in. You know what I mean?
I'm pretty sure that's the case, and I'm pretty sure it's just, at least in the ones I've seen, which I think was the Justice League one and maybe the Star Trek one, it was just a random assembly of images. It wasn't even like from a particular issue.
Yeah, so it's almost like they just picked out the images or the double page spreads that would look the best for someone who wanted to color, you know, would give the people the most options versus like the sequential storytelling from the book. Okay.
Yeah. So I don't think they've got the word balloons, and even if they did, I don't think it'd do any good. So in my mind, this list is for sequential art stories, whether they're original, whether they're collected, whether they're hardcover, softcover, whatever. But coloring books feel like they ought not to be on here. That having been said, they've got a couple of them. We've got the Color Your Own Star Wars, Color Your Own Doctor Strange, Flash as an Adult, which is just an odd title for one, Coloring Your Own Young Marvels, and Color Your Own Deadpool, Coloring DC Wonder Woman, and I think those are all of them.
Interesting.
There might be another one or two hidden on the list. The other item I would not have put on here, because I think it definitely falls into the book category, is at rank 206. We've got the Doctor Strange Fate of Dreams prose novel. Prose novel. To me, that sounds like book.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Does it have, like, is it one of those weird things, like, in manga, something that's really become popular lately is what they're called light novels, and they're basically, like, under 200 page, they're books, but they're in the same universe as the manga, and they have, like, spot illustrations or illustrations every couple pages, so it's, like, this weird quasi, it's not a straight novel, it's not a comic by any sense, because it's got huge chunks of pages of just words, you know, just...
But it's an illustrated story.
Yeah, yeah, in a sense. And then there's that weird, even less so, is where it's literally like they just have a picture at the start of a chapter, and it's basically a novel with a few etchings, kind of like. There's all kinds of weird versions of things.
I don't know. The solicit for this has artists listed as various.
Huh.
So that implies there's a couple of images throughout it.
Yeah.
To be honest, the part I find most interesting about the solicit is the writer is Devin Grayson. I had lost track of her quite some time ago. She, at one point, was doing some stuff over at DC with Nightwing and a couple of the other characters, and she showed a lot of promise as a writer. Was really good on the relationship aspect of the characters, good action sequences and stuff. Her stories were fun to read and felt true to the characters.
Uh-huh.
But she just kind of faded away at one point. Or at least, like I said, I lost track of her. So to find out she's written this novel, kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
So yeah, there are a couple of things on the list that it's like, should they be here or not? Well, they wound up here, so I guess they should be.
Yeah, I almost wonder if it's like a thing of if you know, they set these categories, book, you know, periodical, collected edition. They set them in a time before when any of this kind of like these hybrid content would existed, you know. So now they're just trying to shoehorn in because they don't want to have to create separate categories, and it's just a pain. And so they're just kind of going, well, it looks like a book, even though when you open it, it's a coloring book, you know. So we're going to put it in here. Or it's, yeah, like you said, it's square bound. So that's close enough. So it's a collected edition.
Kind of I'm not even sure who sets the category. It's the publisher.
So, okay. Well, do you think that Diamond gives them like a list of options and they just pick for each product what they want? You know, kind of.
Absolutely. There's a list of about a dozen categories. I've got it around here somewhere. One is comic. I think three is trade. I'd have to go look it up. But yeah, there is definitely a list of these things.
Gotcha.
Let me dig around just for a second and see. This is one of those things where I've moved these things around enough times that I think I've misplaced where I've got that list of control data. Yeah, like I said, I've got it around here somewhere. Because everything in previews, it basically it matches to the sections in previews exactly.
Uh-huh.
So you could use that and say, oh, well, it must be this, it must be that, or whatever. But it's done on an item-by-item basis, and sometimes they put an entire section in one thing versus another, regardless of what the material is. Like the Tomorrow's stuff, I think, used to be in the magazines, moved to the comic section, but I don't think they recategorized the stuff. It's just one of those things that, again, I think the publisher gets to set the category. I'm just not positive of that. And the categories are: one is comics, black and white and color. Two is magazines, comics, games, sports. Three is books, illustrated, comic, graphic novels, trade paperbacks. Four is books, sci-fi, horrors, novels. So clearly the novel should have been there. 5 is games, 6 is cards, sports, non-sports, 7 is novelties, comic material, 8 is novelties, non-comic material, 9 is apparel, t-shirt, caps, 10 is toys and models, 11 is supplies for cards, 12 is supplies for comics, 13 is retailer sales tools, 14 is diamond publications, 15 is posters, prints, portfolios, and calendars, and 16 is video, audio, video games, video games, those three categories in one.
Gotcha.
So there's 16. These are the things you learn as you peruse through the data behind all this stuff at a fairly deep level for about a decade.
Yeah. Sure, there are quite a few interesting quirks you see.
Well, and again, some inconsistencies. There's stuff that, and this is why I think it's the publishers that categorize the stuff. They determine where it would make the most sales sense for them, whether it really makes sense or not. And it's not like these are hard and fast, and if you violate them, oh, there's hell to pay. It's like, no, if you get it wrong, it shows up in the other list. So really not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
One of the other ones I do want to call out real quick is at rank 6, Unbeatable Squirrel Girl beats up the Marvel Universe. This is an original graphic novel. It did 4,541 units. The big call out there is it's an original graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just not that many of those. That I think it's worth kind of calling those out when they happen.
Yeah, it is interesting. One thing to know also, you know, we talked a little bit before this about the benefits of periodical comics and capturing that separate maybe set of customers who are willing to pay weekly. And one of the things that Brian Hibbs argues pretty vehemently against for OGNs is that you miss out on the part of the market that is willing to buy periodical comics. And so he thinks almost everything should be sold issues wise. Obviously, you know, maybe I should say more specifically like superhero genre, things like that. Like obviously there are other things that are, you know, like a literary graphic novel is meant to be like a one-time story or a memoir kind of thing. Maybe may not be, but he just really thinks that when it comes to things like superhero comics and the general stuff is that OGNs, he's not a huge supporter of in terms of, you know, huge pushes at his store outside of what people order, because the ability to make money as you publish a material on top of the OGN, because for him, you know, with his experience, with his 20 plus years of experience, he finds that, yeah, you have maybe good first month sales, but then it once people forget about it, or, you know, if it's not an ongoing series of OGNs, or this is an OGN of an ongoing series that's relatively popular in the same vein as Ms. Marvel has kind of caught on with the maybe new readers in comics, especially the female readers. If you don't have something reinforcing it, an OGN will come and go and it'll just be forgotten. Whereas, you know, with something a little bit more consistently published, you'll be able to build that audience.
There's a number of things in there that I think are worth kind of unpacking and talking about. There's the concept of kind of that over and done with, and then the sales just peter away.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's definitely true. We see that once a miniseries has concluded, once an ongoing title is concluded, that often the interest in that just evaporates over time because there's nothing to sustain it.
Yep.
So certainly a original graphic novel, its moment of that sustenance, if you will, is literally here and gone in an instant.
Yep.
So I totally get with what he's saying there. Now, I would then say original graphic novels, I think, fall into, in this case, two relevant categories of those that are paced such that serializing them would be easy to do, and those that are paced such that serializing them would be bad to do.
Yeah.
Obviously, in the case where it's easy to serialize, sure, why not? Why not just do it as a miniseries and then collect it?
Yeah.
You know, I agree that it's taking one of the revenue streams away from the retailers, and that's just not good.
I find it kind of funny you say, you know, use it as a miniseries. Well, the publishers are terrified of soliciting anything as a miniseries because that automatically caps the interest for some reason, you know. And he's had comms that talk about that too, and how, you know, especially DC and Marvel will say something, oh, this is an ongoing series, and then if it just doesn't do well enough, oh yeah, it was a miniseries the whole time, we just didn't say anything about it.
Well, they did that right before was it Convergence or something?
Yeah.
Around the time we got Arkham Manor and a few other things. And there were a couple where it was clear that the pacing of the story was such that they told the story they set out to tell, and it was not going to be an ongoing series beyond 6 issues.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that is deceptive marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole distinction between an ongoing series and a miniseries is gone.
Yeah.
I mean, for all intents and purposes, my definition right now of a miniseries is very mechanical. It's based on the solicitation and the shipping lists and stuff. If it says a parenthesis of something or other.
Yeah.
You know, if this is solicited as one of six, it is a miniseries.
Well, and you know, a good counterexample and an interesting little corner is Dark Horse's treatment of Hellboy and BPRD, which initially, and I don't know if this was Mignola's idea or if this is how he wanted it, they were always four to six, mostly four and five issue miniseries that were taken together all in this kind of like the Mignola-verse and, you know, different sections, but you always knew there was more coming. And then at a certain point, they went to, I think it was maybe issue 100. Once they hit, when they added them all up, all the miniseries that got to issue 100, they started putting the, you know, 102, 103 on the issues, but also still in the subheading, this, you know, this is issue 136 of BPRD, but this is issue 205 of the Black Flame, you know, you mean? So like, they're still, it's like almost like a mini series within a series, and they wanted both on the cover because some people won't buy, you know what I mean? It's just, it's an interesting quandary.
Absolutely. And it's not the only place that they did that. They also did that with, I think it was the X-Wing stuff when they had the Star Wars property. Mm-hmm. And they would have various, X-Wing Squadron stories as mini series, you know, one of six or whatever. And it got to the point where, since they were doing this month in, month out without breaks, it's like, yeah, it's getting a little hard to keep track of what came when or whatever. We're just going to start numbering them sequentially. Mm-hmm. And I think with the BPRD example, it's kind of a stealthy way to build up that 100 issues and then to be able to cut over and say, see, we've been around for a while. We're not a fly-by-night thing.
Yeah.
But anyone who's kind of knowing of BPRD should have known that anyways.
It was completely baked into the release cycle. I mean, every Mignolaverse series basically was like that. There were 4 to 5 issues. You'd have a story arc. In each story arc, you'd have some underlying plot that would develop the universe and or the large overarching arc that he was doing, kind of like almost like Babylon 5 seasons.
Uh-huh.
Where they do, you know, there's this 5-year story. He's telling a beginning, middle, and an end, and each season had its own goals, and each episode, you know, some episodes didn't have anything to do with the overall arc, but every once in a while you have an episode that the last 10 minutes would relate to the arc. You know what I mean? So kind of that.
Well, it's surprising how much of a difference the way they package the material can make.
Mm-hmm.
Because like you said, some people, well, if it's a miniseries, I'm not going to bother.
Yep.
And in some cases, particularly Marvel and DC, there's a rationale for that because it's not like it's typically going to really matter to the big picture of the universe. There are other people, it's like, well, if I know it's a miniseries and I'm only making a commitment of X dollars, it's like, yeah, okay, I'll give it a shot. Because it means there'll be an end to the story. It's not just meandering forever.
Yeah.
What gets me are the ones that start as the miniseries, get converted to the ongoing series, and then shortly thereafter kind of conclude anyways.
Uh-huh.
A good example of that this time around is at rank 86. We've got Goldie Vance Volume 1 Trade Paperback, 1,264 units.
Uh-huh.
This is collecting issues 1 through 4 of the ongoing series,
mm-hmm.
and it was going to be a 4-issue miniseries. And I could be wrong on this. I'm thinking it's ending at issue 8. I'm not sure. I could be wrong on that. I'd have to go check the solicitations. But it's one of those things that this is where my fairly simplistic and one would argue otherwise authoritative source of is it a miniseries or not would fail me miserably. Because it'd be 1 of 4, 2 of 4, 3 of 4, 4 of 4, 5 of 4, 6 of whatever. You know, it's just... And this is something where on the comic side, I'm trying to be able to identify what titles are kind of suspended of they just didn't ship that month, and which are defunct. They're done.
Yeah.
And not knowing if something has an ending issue or not, or just hasn't solicited for some odd reason for a bit, it's awkward.
Yep.
And I think there's a lot to be said for having stories that have a beginning, a middle, and an end. I think there's an art to telling a story like that in a ongoing serial narrative where you don't end the issue on the word the end, start the next issue on the beginning, and there being a clear dividing line between the two, because that gives people an out. You know, I would almost be tempted to suggest, although I think it would boggle people's minds and therefore be utterly rejected, that imagine if you're reading a comic book, you know, Batman or Superman or X-Men or, you know, whatever, and you get to about page 10 in an issue where they've just done the resolution or epilogue or whatever of the previous story. It says the end, you flip the page, it says the beginning, and they start the next arc.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and have that as something that's a meaningful conclusion to one and a meaningful springboard for the next. I mean, we've had those kinds of breather issues or whatever before, but to actually have the text of the end and the beginning at the end of one page, the start of the next, to clarify that dividing line. Yeah, imagine if the trade paperback collected issues 1 through 6.5, and then the next one had the second half of 6 to, you know, 11 or something.
Mm-hmm.
It would be confusing, but I don't know, it might work. The way they're doing the packaging these days facilitates how they collect some of this stuff, but it also, I think, fundamentally impacts how it sells, more so in a negative sense, rarely in a positive sense.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
See, what else do we have that's interesting this time around? All three volumes of March showed back up on the list. At rank 11, we've got the first volume with 3,962 units of reorder activity. Further down at rank 204, we've got the second volume of March, 533 units of reorder activity. And then at rank 176, we've got volume 3 with 656 units of reorder activity.
Yeah, we're actually going to want to probably pay attention to that book over the next couple months. It just won the National Book Award, and it is, in fact, the first comic to ever do that.
Oh, wow.
So, yep, it won the National Book Award for, I believe, young people's literature. So
great, that's good to hear.
The first comic to ever do that.
I think the civil rights movement in that period in American history is unbelievably pivotal to our country. It was one of many major turning points, moving us, I think, in the right direction towards equality for all.
And I think this series of books is especially a good example for people. You know, I think it's much less of a problem than it was maybe even 5-10 years ago, especially with the way the Marvel movies have kind of really brought everyone into the tent. But there is still a decent amount of adults who don't believe that comics as a storytelling medium is a serious going affair. You know, they just laugh it off. You know what I mean? And I think that this kind of work, the March books and a lot of, you know, adult graphic novels for like memoir and stuff like that, are just really good examples to show people, hey, this is serious literature. You know, this can be it's just a medium to express ideas. You know, just the difference between prose and that, you know, you could do certain things that you can't do in other mediums. And it's just there's nothing to look down upon about comics. And for the small group of people who still think that, this is a good example of work that kind of helps people see, because you kind of have to connect the worlds, right? Like, people that get comics like me and you, we have no problem understanding the vast ability of comics to tell all kinds of stories. But there are certain people, like from the literary side of the world, that they just can't understand that. But if you can show them something like a nonfiction work or a work like this that has fiction elements and nonfiction, you know what I mean? Like, there's a transition there.
I get it. What gets me is if you were to walk up to one of those literary authorities, it's like, oh, you could tell a serious story with comics. Oh, no, you can't. If you were to walk up with them holding, say, a novelization of like a Star Trek story or some other well-known, blatantly fictional thing, you've got that mass market trade paperback, the physical prose book, I mean, in your hand. If you were to walk up to them and say, you mean in this could be like historical factual information? Nah, forget it. They would look at you like you're an utter moron.
Yeah.
And with cause, I get that. Certainly in my case, at least. But the fact that they could then turn right back to you after scoffing at you with a comic book trade paperback and say, this can't possibly have anything of merit historically, you know, relevant or whatever in it, is just that blows my mind. And I know it's a true sort of a situation. It's a medium that has been so relegated to in certain people's minds to just childish, infantile, useless entertainment. Just as some people have written off all of television that way, or all of the YouTube videos or whatever that way. It comes down to, it's not the format the content comes in, it's the quality of the content that matters.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just staggering sometimes. how myopic, I guess, people can be, or prejudiced, I guess, might be the better way. Which is an ironic thing to say about March, which is, again, yeah, about exactly. The whole civil rights thing.
And, you know, a lot, and that's what I mean by that's why this. I'm glad that this is selling well, because this is a great gateway, because the topic of the material. Well, a lot of the people that look down on comics, they obviously it's much harder for them to do that when it's about the civil rights movement. And it's about, you know, like I said, it's a nonfiction view. And probably some of it is, you know, he moved things around or whatever, the guy that interpreted it and drew it. But in terms of like the timeline, but it's pretty, from my understanding, it's a pretty real representation of the things that the congressman went through at that time and the real events. And so it's much harder for those people to say, oh, that's just things for kids when they look at it. And most adults would, you know, have an understanding of, or at least an understanding from school learning about what the civil rights movement was and how intense it was. And obviously big part of why March has been successful is he relates his personal versions of those stories.
Yeah, the whole concept, though, of it's just entertainment for kids and therefore it can't have substance. To me, that's all the more reason people should be sneaking substance into those sorts of entertainment venues.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, you talk to librarians all the time, and when they have reluctant readers, parents have reluctant readers, and they bring their kids in saying, I can't get them to read anything. Well, a lot of librarians start with comics and start with even if it's superheroes, because you're just trying to get them to read it first. But that's one of the, you know, gateways to get kids that are really reluctant to read to actually read, you know, because they at the first the kid just thinks they're looking at pictures, but then they're working on their reading, too. You know what I mean? So there's all kinds of benefits.
Absolutely. I mean, most of the reading I do is comic books, not all of it, but most. And I am a much more avid reader than probably most of the people I hang with, either at work or socially or whatever. But I think in their minds, in many cases, that's just not true because, oh, I'm just reading comics. I'm not really reading. It just, again, people have their own preconceptions and prejudices. It's unfortunate.
Yeah. But I do think things are better in general in the comics medium. And, you know, the last, like I said, the last decade, I think, has done a lot to bring people who wouldn't have considered it in. And I think we do have new fans to the medium who are like, wow, this is, you can tell great stories here and you can have really entertaining things. And you can also have serious, really, you know, really serious comics. So I'm optimistic. Sometimes it might sound to the listeners that I'm not optimistic about it. I'm more, when I'm not optimistic, it's about things that DC and Marvel are doing, but you know.
One thing I want to call out, because it's sort of relevant to this whole discussion about March and stuff and what can be in popular entertainment and stuff like that. I'm watching, obviously, Legends of Tomorrow, the TV show for DC and stuff. Time travel. They had an episode set during around the time of the Civil War, and they actually dealt briefly but poignantly, I thought, about the plight of slavery and what it was like for them. And that's something that, yes, this is in a mass market entertainment TV show venue. It's not like they're going to try to right the wrongs of the world, although arguably that's what this team is trying to do over history. But they can at least potentially open the eyes of some kids today that either haven't studied history or didn't really get it when they read about slavery. Maybe this would open their eyes just a little bit as to, wait, you know, we really have come a long way. What was done back then was wrong, et cetera, et cetera. There are opportunities within popular culture to expand viewpoints, to set subtly agendas and ideals as to, should we be an inclusive culture? Should we not be whatever? And sometimes just, hey, let's play with this idea and see how it plays out. Ooh, that went really badly. Maybe we shouldn't do this. Or, hey, that's what saved the day. Everybody working together. Gosh, that's a great thing. We should all be team players or whatever. I think people can be very dismissive of popular entertainment, be it TVs, movies, games, comics, whatever, when it can have, I think, a subtle yet sometimes very pronounced impact on society.
Mm-hmm.
Are there plans to do a fourth March book?
You know what? I'm not aware of any. I think this is kind of like a bundled set. And the third one is a decent bit bigger than the last two. So it looks like they did try to wrap everything up. But I'm assuming they'll be like a collected, you know, almost like an omnibus edition kind of thing. And they have already done like the paperback box sets, and I'm sure they'll have a hardcover box set. So I'm sure it's a pretty good seller for Top Shelf, the now an imprint of IDW. But my understanding is that they've told that story. Now, if they want to tell further further stories, you know, either the creators or the congressman, I'm not sure, you know, if it's selling well, I'm sure IDW would be open to the option. But as far as I know, it's kind of like that's the completed series.
The solicit for the third one is Top Shelf was honored to present the stunning conclusion to the award-winning and best-selling March trilogy. So like any good trilogy, it could go on for a few more. I'm kidding. If they've got more to tell and it's worth telling, they should.
Yeah, for sure.
Again, that's in period of American history, I find very interesting because, like I said, it was a definite turning point for the country and one where I think we started heading in the right direction. I think, unfortunately, there's still a long way to go for true equality for everybody. But I think people are at least aware that the time is coming for that. Just in some cases, for some people can't get here soon enough, and others are fighting to make sure it doesn't get here. It's like, yeah, whatever. What else do we have in here that looks interesting?
We talked a little bit before we were on the record about The Wicked and Divine selling very well. This is volume 4, and how it looks like McKelvey and I can't, for now I'm forgetting the other guy's
name. Kieran Gillen,
that's right, have kind of like really, they do a very good job of knowing who their audience is and really marketing to it and really have a lot of feedback with them. I think they do a very good job in the letters pages, and their online presence, you know, kind of interacting with their fans, that they've really generated a strong following. And I think that, you know, when they put material out, those people buy it and they're consistently buy it. And I think that their series, you know, that's how you kind of build that sustainable career, because you can always count on those fans. Well, not always, but most of the time count on those fans. And it's just good to see that, you know, I've read Wicked and Divine and I enjoy it. I wouldn't say it's one of my favorite series, but I'm glad that the creators have learned how to focus their attention on the audience that they have. You know, I think one of the biggest problems in comics is that a lot of people, actually think, mistake saying we have to try and bring everyone in. But I think if you can identify your audience and your interests and align them and really focus on that, you can actually survive with a lot less people buying your stuff than you think. Obviously, everyone would love to have Robert Kirkman's success and have those big breakouts. But the reality is that's just almost a lottery game. And if you focus your attention on what you're good at and you focus that and you deliver consistently, you know, that's always a big problem in comics, actually having them come out all the time. But I just think that's a really good strategy for long-term success. You know, everyone wishes to hit the ball out of the park, but if you're going to have a 25, 30 year career, you really need to give your customers, you know, that attention and feedback, especially in the modern, social media age.
Absolutely. That reminded me of a conversation I had with Adam Withers at C2E2, I think, last year. He and Comfort Love did they've done a few series, The Uniques, I forget what the other ones were called off the top of my head. Some great stuff. I loved it. But they did a book called The Complete Guide to Self-Publishing Comics. Had to go turn around and look at it on the shelf. And one of the comments he made when I was talking with him at C2E2 was how if you have, and I forget how many he said, it might have been 1,000, 10,000, there was a particular number of loyal fans, you're set.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was a manageable number. Mm-hmm. But his definition of loyal fan, which I thought was obviously a key point, was very interesting. It's something that if you come out with something that's, you know, $50 or less, they'll buy it. Now, granted, you're not going to go to the 50 buck well multiple times, maybe like twice a year you could do, but not like, you know, every week or something. But if you can get somebody that's enough of a fan of your work that they'll plop down up to $50, you know, on a twice a year basis on a recurring kind of a thing, you're set. It's not like you've got to top the sales charts. You just need to have not a lot of people reading your stuff, but the right people reading your stuff that will become those loyal fans that will support you and allow you to do what you want to do. And if you can get fans that are supporting the material you want to be doing versus doing the material fans will support, makes a world of difference. Because then everything can be your passion project versus just what you're doing to pay the bills.
Absolutely.
And I think there's a lot to be said for, you know, some of the numbers we talk about on this list are not staggering sales numbers. You know, some of them, when we get down to about the halfway point on the list, we're at about, 774 units thereabouts. So that's a very, I was going to say a very doable number of units. Clearly, it's a challenging number of units because, well, half the list didn't make it this time. But I think it's not like you're a crazy unreasonable expectation. You know, if you get 1,000 units, you're doing pretty well on this list. And this, some of this is reorder activity, but a lot of this is new material. If you've got that right 1,000 people or something versus a couple of people who sampled it, whatever, you know, it's you don't need to have a huge following. You need to have a loyal following.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, as a were I a creator, I would forego 10 wishy-washy, you know, casual fans for one that is just a diehard, true, loyal supporter. Because those are the ones that that are the bread and butter that keep things going. I mean, I wouldn't want to have to give up the other 10, don't get me wrong. But, for instance, with this podcast, there is a select number of people that contribute to the preview spotlight every month, and it's a tiny fraction of the number of people that are listening to those episodes. And it's open submission. It takes a few minutes just to find a recording app on your smartphone, click record, email it to me, and you're done. So it's not like even a significant amount of effort or whatever. But I've got some people that reliably do that each and every month. Some, like Brawlinator, with some decent production values even. And better than I usually put into the podcast myself, honestly. So there's, again, the that loyal base of fans that are keeping that stuff going versus all the people listening. You need some of both, don't get me wrong. But when I look at some of these sales numbers in the couple hundred units range, I'm thinking, you know, if you know what your target audience is or looks like, and you can figure out how to reach out to them through social media, through email, through bulletin board, you know, message boards or whatever, there are cost-effective ways in this day and age of social media to find those people, let them know about your material, and hopefully sell them on it, that getting a couple hundred units shouldn't be that impossible. Now, I think realistically, you're going to have somebody who's a social media maven separate from the creator who actually makes the material to kind of make all that work out. But again, finding that one key uber fan that can then facilitate you getting the rest of those fans, that too should be possible. It's just one of those things that it's not there's a quality and quantity aspect to be had here on the nature of the sales for these trades. You know, we talk about, again, how high some of these sales are, how low some of the other ones are. To your point earlier, there are certain books that do gangbusters on trade, not so much on the periodical side, and a different set of titles that may do really sensationally on the digital side. And kind of, you know, maybe lackluster in print. You know, nothing right or wrong about any of those things, but if you can find your audience and get the right material, not get the right material for them, if you can find the audience that's right for your material and get to them, that's where success is, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. I just think that so often, you know, and maybe it's just the hard reality of the economics of it, where you have to sell as many copies as possible to stay in the game, but, you know, kind of honing your audience, I think maybe it's easier to do that once you have a base to work from, but it just sees so many people just, you know, kind of the shotgun approach, and it just, especially at places like Marvel with how many books they publish. But yeah, we'll see.
There's definitely the shotgun approach, don't get me wrong. I see that very often, again, particularly in the Marvel output's a great example of that. Gee, the Guardians of the Galaxy movie did well. Let's give each member of the team their own book. Well, golly, Deadpool's doing well. Let's give him a team and then give every member of that team their own book. They're off on another one, so let's give him another team. And I would not be surprised if this second team of Mercs for the Money or whatever winds up with each of them getting their own book in about 4 to 6 months. You know, there's an almost formulaic aspect to that. Now, there's the mercenary view of, well, geez, that's just, you know, formulaic, that's bad. There's also a potential vantage point on this of, by giving each of those their own miniseries or whatever, not that I think Solo or Slapstick or Fool Killer or some of these others really need it, but you're at least expanding the library. Well, you're not expanding the library. These characters have been around for ages. You're expanding the potential audience for those properties.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some potential good that can come of it, but I'm personally expecting most of those miniseries to get a collection, we see it once on this list and then promptly forget about it because we never see it again. But, you know, we'll see. Obviously, we've got a couple of Doctor Strange things on the list with the movie coming out or out. Go figure. We've got the Doctor Strange Prelude at 46 with 2004 units. We've got all sorts of other trades scattered around. The Doctor Strange Epic Collection, a few items below it, are ranked 51 with 1,893 units. That collects, a bunch of stuff. A lot of it from 68, a few of it from more recent, well, I guess 74, that's about as recent as it is. I'm not sure which volume of all of the Doctor Strange stuff this would wind up being over time. They don't number their epic collections when they put them on the trade, when they put them on the sales list here. Perhaps one of the more surprising items on this list is at rank 64. And looking at the retail ranking, it's not like uber discounted or something, but it's the Convergence trade paperback. 1,567 units.
Yeah, it's probably 1,550 too many, but yeah.
Not going to say you're wrong there. I'm saying I'm surprised it's on the list with legit sales.
Yeah.
It may be the first time it hit trade, though. Mm-hmm. But it had the 0 to 8 of the regular, of the miniseries itself by Tom King. Yeah, that one's just a little bit surprising.
So they did do a hardcover before?
I'm pretty sure they did, and that would have been, I'm thinking 6 months ago, but I could be wrong on that. Maybe a little longer ago.
Makes sense.
It's, I have a hard time keeping track of when the trades and the hardcovers come out. At rank 125, we've got Batman Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles hardcover. It's reorder activity, 923 units, bringing its total up to 9,187. That was the first crossover between those two properties. The second one, based on the cartoons, just started up. Matter of fact, Drew and I just reviewed that on the last weekly comic spotlight. So what else on the list caught your eye?
Interesting, a little bit lower on number 81, Valiant Masters Shadow Man Volume 1 Spirit Within. Interesting to see, and that's his actual reorder activity, interesting to see you know, Valiant issuing some of its older stuff. That's what the Master series is. And that seems to be some demand for it. So that's kind of good to see. You know, that they've kind of created their own new modern universe, but it looks like there's some maybe nostalgia or some people that are Valiant completists trying to check some of that older stuff out. Because I remember liking some of that early material.
They've been doing that pretty much since this Valiant started up, focusing more on EXO and a few of those things.
Yeah. So well, this is the first one I remember seeing. I'm sure they have been on the – I just – you asked me what was interesting.
Yeah.
It's good to see that they're having success with some of their older material, you know, already paid for and able to generate revenue to then further, submit new material. So.
Absolutely. And I respect the fact that they're charting a new course for their characters, yet being respectful and stuff of the previous go rounds.
Uh-huh.
You know, and keeping that material out there, I think, is just a smart move. The fact that this is Shadow Man, and he's kind of nowhere to be seen, by and large, in the Valiant universe at the moment, as far as I recall.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting. He's more or less, I don't say been replaced by, but that sort of supernatural role is Punk Mambo is the character they tend to go with these days.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is good for Valiant's older stuff to be getting, like I said, back into print and hopefully out there to a new audience. One of the things further down on the list at rank 250 is Miraculous Origins from Action Lab Entertainments. This is a $9.99 digest kind of a thing, manga size trade, I believe. And it, I think, is what collected the first three issues of the comic book series they've done. I've got those issues. I've read those issues. They were actually fairly thick issues, at least 48 pages. And it was basically Miraculous is a computer animated series on, I think, Nickelodeon. I could be wrong on that. But they've basically used stills from the show as the artwork for it. but in a way that, that works surprisingly well, because I've seen this done before abysmally, but here it's successful. Okay. But what they did is they did the three issues on, I think, a weekly basis and solicited this trade concurrently.
Gotcha. Okay.
So it only did 417 units, given the way they put it out there, I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
And then way down on the list, some interesting reorder activity at 296. This is Injustice Gods Among Us Volume 1 Trade Paperback. It's obviously reorder activity, been on the list 16 times before. Only 363 units, but it's total up to 13,066 units. And they just, I think, kicked off the latest Injustice series that kind of covers the events of the first game from Harley Quinn's point of view, maybe. I haven't read it yet. But this Injustice Gods Among Us went on for like 5 years.
Yeah. Are they, is that going to be in the same vein where they're releasing, the printed comic is like two or three of the digital comic issues or something like that? Like, is it going to be follow the same kind of pattern as the Injustice?
The new series?
Yeah.
Yes, I believe so. Okay. It's all a digital first. Two of them gets collected, two or three, depending, into the print comic, and the six of the print comics got collected into this volume.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Yeah, I ordered these. I have these collections in the paperback, the whole year collection. So how they broke it down in terms of the collected editions, like you said, five or six issues in each collected edition, and then two of them per year. So I've just been buying the collected year one. So it's like Injustice Gods Among Us year one, year two, year three, year four, year five. They've solicited, I think, I've got one and two, and I think they solicited three soon. So they're a little bit behind, because obviously, you know, it's kind of like the end line collected edition version of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great stuff.
Yeah. No, I really like it. I wouldn't be surprised if we eventually see like an omnibus. I don't know if they would all fit, but if they can, I'm sure they'll try for that too.
What I would be tempted to do with this, once it hits kind of that end point, depending where the story is when it winds down, if you still have the evil regime or whatever in power, I would cross it over with the mainstream universe.
Yeah, that's actually not a bad idea.
Because there's sort of a there, but for the grace of God, we go sort of aspect to it.
And you know what? They've already set the precedent by bringing in the Watchmen universe into the Rebirth stuff. So if you can cross those universes, you can cross this one into.
Yeah.
So
it would be it'd be a fun kind of a swan song for that, and a very interesting potential wake up call for the mainstream heroes of things could go really badly.
Yeah. I'm sure the fanboys on the internet would be even more excited to yell, because one thing they have a hard time with the movie Superman is he's too dark and broody and moody. And the Injustice Superman is pretty much a villain, so.
Yeah, very much so.
It'll be interesting to see how they react to that.
he actually makes the one from Man of Steel look like a pretty mellow guy.
Yeah, pretty happy, yeah.
Yeah, pretty upbeat. It's funny. Yeah.
So, yeah, good point. But yeah, you're right. They you know, they have that option, and obviously it's been successful for them. It's coming out of like a, you know, video game tie-in, something that you usually don't see as successful. So when you have something like that, you can build on it, you know, and hopefully they respect the property and don't do to it like you've talked about it before, when Dynamite had like 14 different Green Hornet series, when there may not have been enough demand for even one and a half Green Hornet series. And, you know, that you have to always worry about that problem.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of don't oversaturate.
Yeah.
And like, I think that's where Marvel's at risk with all the miniseries, or not miniseries, but all the solo series they're doing for a couple of their team characters.
Oh my gosh. I was just going to bring up, like, and I'll give you a perfect, you know, Green Hornet's kind of in the past. I'll give you a perfect example. They have like 42 books with Deadpool in it, and they're so intent on publishing as many Deadpool books as possible that I cannot take it.
I think they've got plenty of Deadpool books, but it's the team of mercenaries, each of them getting their own book, that gets me.
Yeah, that's what I mean, is just like the whole I don't fault anyone who really enjoys a character enjoying it. Like, you know, DC does a little bit with the Harley Quinn success. They've been starting to branch that little mini universe of the Bat universe out, you know, a different branch on the tree. You know, the Harley Quinn book was successful with Palmiotti and Connor. So we'll do Harley and her little black book, and we'll do all these little different things. But Marvel is the worst, man. They have so many Deadpool books or Deadpool associated people books. Oh, they had, remember when they had all those Wolverine books, and it's just, yeah. Oh, it kills me.
But imagine if that team of other Harleys, if each one of those got their own series.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I mean. It's like, you know, you've talked in the past about like a lot of, sometimes, especially at Marvel, they'll give the C or D level characters a book just to see if it catches on, you know, if you have this once in a 100 Miss Marvel, you know, success. But like you said, sometimes we're taking C-level characters and splitting off their like sidekicks and enemies into books, and you're like, how is this possibly going to work?
I want to be sure we don't accidentally conflate Ms. Marvel in with this group of characters.
Yeah.
Because to me, this is a bunch of like G or H list characters that they're throwing out there. Ms. Marvel, I saw a really interesting TED talk that the editor had done. Uh-huh. Sama Aminat, I believe is her name. And she was very eloquent about the fact that when, you know, as a comic fan growing up, there were not many characters she, as a young female Muslim American, could relate to. And she's gotten to be an editor at Marvel. She was instrumental in getting the Ms. Marvel character kind of created and out there. It was a young female Muslim American. And as a older white male American, it's a little hard for me to relate to the character, but that's actually one of the things I enjoy about the series, is it's a character that's got a fundamentally different point of view at times than I do, and that many of the other Marvel uh-huh. characters have. So it's one that you could argue, oh, well, they're just going for the diversity angle or whatever. It's like, yes, and that's not a bad thing. They're not doing it as a token character. They're doing it as one that can represent an otherwise, at the time, completely unrepresented portion of the potential comic audience. And
yeah, I agree.
Again, I see characters like that, and I'm trying to think of a few others that come to mind that fill an otherwise gap in the roster, if you will, of these characters. I'm going to go with Miles Morales. You know, when you've got actors taking roles in the Marvel movies that are non-white saying they're doing it because I want to show to my son that non-white people can be heroes. I'm like, wow, something is just fundamentally wrong with the characters we've got in our comics to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, I think maybe they've gone a little overboard, because it is getting to where when I look at half these teams, it's a little hard for me to find a character as a white male American I can relate to. But, you know, hey, that's a rough life. I'll live with it.
Yeah. And it's with everything. There's so many comics. There's definitely places to find what you want.
Yeah. And it's not a bad thing to see how people of different backgrounds, how they would be as heroes, how they would be in a TV sitcom or whatever. But to me, again, that's the Ms. Marvel character is a different case versus the let's take a bunch of characters that we tried to have success with in decades past, failed, trot them back out as if they're now somehow magically relevant, and with the expectation they'll do better, when the realistic aspect is they probably won't.
Yeah.
I mean, I will be amazed if we wind up with a breakout series out of all of these solo books coming out of Guardians of the Galaxy, the Deadpool Mercs for the Money, or some of these other things. It, to me, feels like a more blatant cash grab.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what it is. It's just they're trying to capitalize while the character is hot, and they'll burn it out. And then at a certain point, you know, they'll wonder what happened, and it'll be obvious to everyone but them, you know. And it may even be obvious to them, and that just may be their philosophy. Like, Marvel has always been about the short term over the long term, you know. And in a lot of ways, it's worked for them. You know, I can't fault them for being relatively successful in almost everything they do. It's just, I don't necessarily like some of the practices they involve themselves in. So,
but imagine how successful they could be if they weren't so either cynical, mercenary, or however you might want to paint that.
Yeah, and I'm sure at the next board meeting they'd love to talk to about the return on investment of that. You know, I mean, I completely agree with you, but it's just, you know, the incentives are not aligned for everyone in the business. Let's just say that.
Absolutely. And if they're having success, there's no reason for them to change their practices.
Exactly.
There needs to be a business reason for them to do something different. And again, they're often top dog on the comic side. They're doing well on the trade side. Obviously, they're doing gangbusters on movies. So from a very dollars and cents perspective, it's not like anything's broken. You know, creatively, you could argue, but you know what? Who cares?
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things I always find fascinating going over the sales numbers is how the marketplace is reacting versus how I personally have reacted to some of these properties. Because there are times where I've got to look fairly far down the list for some of the stuff I'm reading. And stuff at the top, I'm like, yeah, I read it, but there's better stuff down below. But again, that's my perspective. Other people are going to have different vantage points as to what's the best stuff out there. There's no empirical metric to be had on that.
Yeah.
One thing I do want to mention is down at rank 360, this is some of the stuff that's kind of below the radar. We do have another one of those Valiant Masters. In this case, we've got Rye. And this is collecting the original stuff, I believe, from, 1992. So again, they've been doing a good job. And this is reorder activity, by the way. Supporting the older take on the Valiant universe in addition to their current one. And I think this is a smart strategic move for them to be slowly building up this library of material and collections to where, say, when they come out with their movies, if there's a big demand for this stuff, it's just a matter of going back to print versus having to collect initially.
Mm-hmm.
If we take a look at the price points, man, they are just all over the place. $14.99 was popular, $9.99 was popular, $19.99 was popular, but those three only account for about 47.67% of the items on the list. There's just a bunch of things, everything from as low as $4.99 to as high as $125. That's what I mean to say. There comes a point where I'm looking at enough of these numbers that clearly I lose the ability to read them. Let's see. Of those $125 items, we've got the Spider-Man Clone Saga Omnibus Volume 1 hardcover. Wow, 1,012 units. That's pretty good. That's understandable. The second highest retail rank. The Shang-Chi Master of Kung Fu Omnibus and the Girl Power Amanda Connor Gallery Edition, which is collecting stuff from Power Girl number 1, 7, 8, 9, the 12 Supergirl chapters of Wednesday Comics, and the entire Before Watchmen Silk Spectre saga. And that's in a 12x17 size. I have not gotten one of these gallery editions yet. Have you?
No, I have not.
They're kind of sort of the equivalent of the artist edition.
Mm-hmm.
It's just... again, oversized presentation of the original artwork before the coloring and stuff like that. And Amanda Connor definitely deserving of one. So, again, a couple of high price point items. If we look at the bottom, the cheapest one, again, was a Pokemon XY Volume 8 graphic novel for $4.99. It did 480 units. And I'm not sure what the page count on that is. I'm kind of curious. So, again, price points all over the place in terms of... In terms of gains versus losses, this is kind of entertaining because it's gotten to the point where so many things are volume ones of something that finding a volumes to compare against is not common. And most of them went down by a little bit compared to the total known sales of everything else. There is only one that went up. I really ought to change this to initial month sales. But what's kind of humorous is the total losses from volume to volume are 59,840 units. The total gains, 2. Because the only thing that my list found that had a gain was the Astro Boy Omnibus Volume 5, which did 442 units, whereas the previous volume did 440 units and never showed up again on the list to do any reorder activity. Which, frankly, isn't too surprising. I think Astro Boy is a little bit of a nostalgia and eclectic taste.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, yeah. It's getting to where volume-over-volume comparisons on this list are so challenging because of the number of volume ones, the number of different ways they collect the stuff. And that's also what would make doing a title-by-title comparison hard is, lumping everything together for that title. So, yeah. So anything else? Or does that pretty much do it?
No, I think that does it. Just kind of a one of those more stationary months. We're still waiting to see. When, is it a month or two before we actually see the first Rebirth trades come out? Or maybe is it the end of December or January? I can't remember.
I'm not sure. It shouldn't be too long now because the story arcs, the first ones have finished. Yeah. They've been solicited. I don't know. I would imagine if they don't get released in... I'm thinking they're going to get released in December.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Obviously, you know, you want to be able to have, especially for the volume ones, which are always in general some of your best sellers, and especially with Rebirth, you know, maybe DC wants to give the people who potentially read trades a chance to get, you know, a good chunk of the story, then jump on the single issue boat if possible. And maybe if they're smart, they do some advertising to that effect in the trades or in the books or whatnot. But yeah, I think the next month's numbers should be interesting to see, and then. I've been following you and Sam's work over on the individual issues, and it's an interesting time, to say the least, in the single issues.
It is. It is very interesting. We've had some of the record highs, then it dropped, and then we got what would have been the second record high this time around. It's all over the place at times, and trying to figure out where the units are coming and going from has been kind of fun.
Well, I think that some of the volatility is that, as much as I hate to admit it, I think a lot of the publishers are embracing variants again. And even if they, you know, it's almost like they can't help themselves. I mean, Marvel is a full-on addict, but I think some of the other publishers are just, you know, they're just seeing the dollar signs and they're seeing how it moves and they're doing it. So it's going to be interesting to see how it works.
It's funny you mention that because one of the threads on the forum recently has been on the U.S. Avengers number one variants. You know, which Avengers got labeled for which states and whatnot. Boy. So yeah, there's like 50 some odd, I think 60 covers for that one issue.
Oh, God.
They're at least original art for each one.
And I understand it's only like, you know, they don't do that every month, but it just, you know, there are distinctive lessons learned from the 90s crash. And there were certain things that were very evident as to contributors, and people in the industry who've been there long enough know what those were. And there are some people that still are using those tools, and they know that they're double-sided swords, and they think that they can be the one that manages to only cut one way, but you got to be very careful with those.
Well, that U.S. Avengers stands a good chance of its first issue topping the charts and then dropping by, say, 90 or more percent.
Yeah, I would guess more than 90%, yeah.
But if you really make some serious bank on that first issue, maybe that's okay. Well, but I think that issue will have more variance than DC has had in some recent months.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you say, well, you make some bank. Yeah. And I would say, and all those, yes, you got that money, but 70% of those issues are sitting in, you know, maybe not that high, who knows, but are sitting in quarter and dollar bins, you know, by the long box full somewhere.
I think that's less likely to happen with this since they were independently orderable.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. There shouldn't be as many.
But I hope people aren't speculating too much on them.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the biggest problems, you know, within the 90s is people just, there's just no way the comics, we needed that, you know, not needed that many comics. That's the wrong way to say it, is that you just had so many comics that never actually got sold to people to read, you know?
The market was buying more than it could support.
Yeah.
There was absolutely not a readership for all of that, and that's why I qualify, you know, again, the dollars into different categories, and some of them are bad dollars to get.
Yeah.
And I totally think the variants are a risky proposition. When Marvel first started doing the theme variants years ago with, like, the zombie variants, I was able to track a 5,000 to 7,000 unit bump on the issues that had that. Now, this day and age, we've got titles that aren't even doing the 5 or 7,000 to begin with sometimes.
Yeah.
And the bump is much harder to track because there's more variance and also less pronounced. But let's say if it's even a 1,000 or 2 units across the board that a variant on a Marvel or DC title might bring, and those people wake up and decide, you know what, this isn't worth it. I'm not getting whatever I get out of it. And they stop, and suddenly those sales just evaporate, as they did in the 90s in fairly short order. That's a lot of units that pull out of the market.
Uh-huh.
And that has a definite ripple effect. and one that in very short order could be very disastrous. The industry is not healthy enough to sustain that loss right now.
Especially with the way that stores have to pre-order months ahead of time. Obviously, final order cutoff helps, but and it's such a cash business. You know, one of the most important things I've learned from the Brian Hibbs model, I mean, he obviously probably takes care of his, you know, plus and minus in his store a lot better than most. There's so many stores that need the money from each week to be able to afford the next week. And when you, if you have those drops, you're just asking for store closings, you know?
Well, let's put it this way. Brian Hibbs was able to buy another store.
Yeah, exactly.
He clearly knows what he's doing and has made money. And I would say that's because he's one of the more cognizant retailers out there who's not doing this just as a lark. It's his livelihood. It clearly is what he should be doing too. He does it well. So I just don't know how many retailers fall into that kind of category versus those that are, again, week to week, month to month kind of survival.
Well, I for one hope that we don't find out anytime soon. Yeah.
We don't have to find Amen out. To that. I am right there with you on that.
I would love for the numbers to, you know, be steady and growing, you know, for a long time. That would be good. So let's just hope for the best. And I'll keep listening to your podcast, and I'll keep listening to the tone in Sam's voice being like, I don't understand how they're selling all of these. And then you telling, well, they aren't selling all of them. They're selling most of them, and then some of them sit in boxes.
As long as they sell enough of them and we've got a good, healthy trend, that's what matters. And I think we're heading in the right direction. But it wouldn't take a whole lot to upset the apple cart, I think.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. So with that, I think we'll call it an episode.
Sounds good.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If you differ from your reality, please verify that you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there is at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or SKUs and items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside of Diamond Comics distribution channels is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer's here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Ath logic and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.